Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We'll start the program today with two guests. One of them is a rising star in Virginia politics, where it must be a very interesting time to be a rising star, while everyone at the top of state government is falling in nationally compelling scandals that go to the biggest cultural questions of our time, right? But Virginia House of Delegates member Jennifer Carroll Foy is literally a rising star in that she was just nominated for the Emily's List Gabrielle Giffords Rising Star Award a few days ago. She's profiled in Glamour magazine this week, too, and there are people calling for her to be the next governor or lieutenant governor of Virginia, even though she just started serving in the legislature last year. She was one of the first women to go to college at the Virginia Military Institute, joining their third co-ed class. She is the only public defender in the legislature. We know that former prosecutors often get elected. She's one of only 19 African Americans in the legislature of 140 people, even though about 20% of Virginia's population is black, and only about a quarter of the legislature is female. Delegate Foy certainly has her opinions about Governor Ralph Northam, Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, and Attorney General Mark Herring, the third in line, who also admitted to wearing blackface. But it may be fair to say that all the scandal stuff is only the second most important reason that Delegate Foy is here today. That's because she is also a leader in a movement that is ongoing, but a little under the radar, considering the potential significance of it, the movement to get an Equal Rights Amendment into the U.S. Constitution that would make discrimination on the basis of sex explicitly unconstitutional. Now, as it happens, Virginia has been getting close to ratifying the ERA, and if they do, watch the skies, because that would technically make enough states ratifying, 38, that the ERA could become the 28th Amendment to the Constitution. But there are legal questions about what states actually count, so the momentousness of it all would likely bring a world-class legal battle raining down on us, ERA ratified or not. We'll explain why as we go. Our other guest is a national leader in the ERA movement. Kamala Lopez is founder and executive director of the group Equal Means Equal, and an actor and a Yale philosophy grad. Maybe you know her from Sesame Street or films like I Heart Huckabees. That 2004 movie was not about Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I presume. And in 2009, Kamala Lopez launched the renewed movement to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment language simply says, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. And Section 2, the Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. So, Ms. Lopez and Delegate Foy, thank you so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you
for having me.
And we'll do ERA first, the mess in Virginia, and the implications for us all second. But Delegate Foy, can you tell us a little bit about yourself first? Where'd you grow up and what got you into politics?
Absolutely. So I was born and raised in Petersburg, Virginia, pretty meager beginnings. I was raised by my grandmother. I like to say I had a very traditional Southern childhood.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Oh.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, and what got you into, I think Kamala was trying to talk also, but what got you into politics?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So, I've always been politically active. I supported Restoration of Rights initiatives and Get Out the Vote. I supported Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama. And shortly after Trump's election and seeing a lot of the legislation coming out of the General Assembly in Virginia, such as the Day of Tears, where there was a resolution presented to make Roe versus Wade anniversary a day of mourning for the state, state and all flags have to be flown half-staff. So after efforts such as that to humiliate and embarrass and shame women after Trump's election and the conversations around the country that was happening with a person who was so misogynistic and shown that he proved to be bigot and, you know, incompetent in areas of social justice issues and the economy, I just decided that we needed to change the conversation and that needed to be the change that I needed to see. So I decided to run.
Well, good for you. And what made you get interested in the ERA? I mean, many people who are Gen X and up probably think of it as a relic of the 70s and 80s, and they're surprised that this is even a topic on our show today. So what drew you to this?
Absolutely. So I remember being in high school and watching the Supreme Court decision, the Virginia Military Institute Supreme Court decision, and realizing in that moment that VMI, one of the top military colleges in this country, had spent millions of dollars to keep women out of its doors. And people use justifications such as women are naturally, biologically inferior to men, both physically and mentally, that we would be distraction to men, that wasn't our place. So I remember Justice Ginsburg saying that, and I'm paraphrasing, that women can do all things if given the opportunity, and I agreed. So I decided to go to VMI, and I was actually in a third class of women to graduate. And I knew at that time then that I was relegated to second-class citizenship because of my gender. And there would be obstacles in before me because I was female. And so I knew then how important the Equal Rights Amendment was to help end sex discrimination. Because the Constitution doesn't do an adequate job, we don't have the same protections that's provided for race, national origin, in religion, in the Constitution, we're treated as a lower standard. That's why women lose sex discrimination cases. Mm-hmm. That's why we're not paid what we're worth equal to men. So I knew that this was something I needed to champion.
And Ms. Lopez, what about you? Why has reviving the ERA, which was widely considered defeated way back in 1982 when the original clock ran out for ratification by the states, why has this become central to your life's work?
Well, I think what happened to me, as distinct from Jennifer, is that I had no idea that I was a second class citizen. I thought I was in the premium class. I thought I was up there and that I could be, do, and have whatever I wanted. So when I ran into the invisible elephant in the middle of the American society's living room, which is that women are still being legally treated under the same standards of a constitution written in 1787, when women were chattel. When that smacked me in the face, I felt so deeply betrayed by our government because I had not been informed that the playing field was completely unlevel and that all the blame that women are putting on themselves are actually blame that needs to go on the institution and on the government, instead of women internalizing their supposed failures.
Now, some skeptics of ERA as a priority say sex discrimination suits get filed all the time based on existing civil rights laws. So for practical purposes, is gender discrimination already as illegal as it would be under a constitutional amendment?
Absolutely not. The fact is that in the 22 states where there is an Equal Rights Amendment, women win cases at over 80%, where in states where there is no ERA, women have a 50-50 shot of getting justice. We know for a fact, after doing research for 10 years, I can tell you that there are 26 at least areas in our society where women are experiencing discrimination that would be mitigated by an Equal Rights Amendment. The fact that this has been glossed over and that two generations of American women have been gaslighted to believe that they have what they don't is a massive civil rights violation of the majority of the population. And we're seeing an example of that in the fact that Speaker Kirk Cox, who sits in the Virginia House of Delegates, refuses to put the ERA on the floor for a full vote. So To a great degree, the will of one man trumps the rights of 161 million women, and that's where we have a problem in this country.
And we'll get to that with Delegate Foy. that defeat in a House of Delegates committee in Virginia by just a 4-2 vote rather than putting it on the full floor. But let me first play two archive clips from the 1970s that will either make both of you laugh or cry, and then ask who you see your opposition to be in 2019. In the 1970s, the most well-known opponent of the ERA, as I'm sure you know, was the superstar of the cultural right, Phyllis Schlafly, who spoke in terms that I don't think even many religious right evangelicals would use today. So here are two clips. The first one is from Good Morning America in 1976, when Schlafly argued against the ERA because it would force women to be subject to the draft, she said, equally to men.
Okay, well, that's a fundamental difference between those who are for ERA and those who are against it. You think my daughter should serve. I think women should have the choice not to serve.
So she was pro-choice in that respect. And then this one is from a speech, again, still during the active ERA ratification years. This is from 1977.
The laws of all the 50 states say that the husband must provide the financial support for his wife. These are good laws. These are laws which give to the wife her right to be a full-time homemaker. Laws which establish the obligation of the husband and father to provide the financial support of his family. These laws are designed to keep the family together, to give the baby a mother in the home. They're good laws. But they're not sex equal. If we have it in our Constitution that you can never make any law that has a difference of treatment based on sex, all those laws must become sex equal. They cannot have a difference of treatment. Now, what will ERA do to the law that says the husband must support his wife?
Phyllis Schlafly in 1978. Kamala, are you...
I have her last interview. I have her last interview. It was over an hour long, and she was 90-something when I interviewed her. And I have to say that I decided not to put her in the film because her views were so outdated and she appeared to be such a dinosaur that I felt actually guilty about, you know, I felt like it would be elder abuse. I mean, it was crazy, some of the things she said. She said that unwed mothers needed to give their babies up for adoption, move back in with their parents, and then go get a job.
And you're talking about your film, Equal Means Equal, which has the same title as your group. So my guess is today that even President Hannity or Vice President's Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham wouldn't use those arguments. Tell me if you disagree, but Ms. Lopez, would there be that kind of cultural opposition expressed in some way?
So first of all, I want to say that the opposition to the ERA, in my opinion, after a long deal of research, it was astroturf, meaning this wasn't a natural uprising of the grassroots, which is what equal means equal and the new movement is. This was a movement that was bought and paid for. There were a lot of vested interests that still exist. When you can pay a woman between 56 and 22 cents less on the dollar every hour, believe me, there are entrenched interests that do not want to see this happen. When you have the largest private employer in the United States of America, Walmart, forcing a class action lawsuit with 1.5 million women saying they're being discriminated against, and they get that kicked out on the basis of the class being too large, not on the basis of the preponderance of the evidence that Walmart discriminates against women in pay promotions, et cetera.
So do you think that the opposition would be primarily economic and business-oriented rather than cultural?
I believe that the cult, that the economic and business interests wrap themselves in the cultural because it's more effective. I think the opposition is funding a lot of these, what I call radical right-wing groups that purport to be pro-life but truly are about suppressing women's rights through the guise of misleading religious individuals and convincing them that the ERA has something to do with abortion, which it has zero, nothing to do with at all.
So, Delegate Foy, if Virginia passes the ERA, it would be the 38th state, meaning it would have gotten the 3/4 of the states needed under the Constitution to ratify an amendment. I see the Virginia Senate passed an ERA resolution last month but then a House committee on merely a 4-2 vote defeated it a few weeks ago. So tell us what happened and how definitive is that for 2019?
Absolutely. So, yes, Wyatt passed the Senate, and the Equal Rights Amendment has passed the Senate several times in previous years. On the House side, it was defeated in the subcommittee, but the subcommittee only gives recommendations for the full committee. So then it was brought up by a Democrat in the full committee, and it was still defeated, so it wasn't able to make it to the floor for a full vote. However, I'm happy to announce today that yesterday, the Democrats put in a rule change. So what the rule change demands is for the ability with the majority of the vote to discharge the Equal Rights Amendment out of the Privileges and Elections Committee. Because our position is, with 81% of all Virginians, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Conservatives, and liberals alike supporting the Equal Rights Amendment, one man, Speaker Cox, should not stand in the way of this getting done. For all 99 of us having our vote on the floor representing 8 million Virginians, we should be able to push the button and make sure that our constituents' voices are heard.
So this is breaking news. The Equal Rights Amendment process, which was declared dead in Virginia a few weeks ago for this year, is not dead yet. And I'm just curious, is this breaking down along party lines in the Virginia legislature? And if so, why do the Republicans say they oppose it?
Absolutely. So all 48 current Democrats have signed on to the Equal Rights Amendment resolution. I don't believe any of the Republicans have come out to support as far as signing on to the resolution. So the Senate version has passed with the Republican sponsor has passed the Equal Rights Amendment resolution, and so that's the one that's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
The one that they basically killed was the one that I was sponsoring. So State Senator Sturtevant is still alive and well, and it's just stuck in the Privileges and Elections Committee. So the reasons that they're giving are a lot of the same reasons that they gave for not supporting other issues that people try to term as progressive, but it's really not. It's just about doing what's right so that women they'll now be unisex bathrooms. I believe one delegate, I think it was Delegate LaRocque, said that once women have equal rights, they'll start taking their tops off, and that was an issue for him. You also had other things that they try to say about their rescission and the deadline. And even though we've answered those questions, given them a booklet that's over 100 pages detailing addressing all of their concerns, they are still digging in their heels because the Family Foundation is present in Richmond. They have lobbyists that's showing up. They are dedicated to contributing huge amounts of money to the Republican Party if they dig in their heels against women's equality, and that is what's unfortunate and sad. So, again, 160 million women and girls are waiting with bated breath across this country for their constitutional equality. And like I said before, never again will any of us in Virginia take such an important vote that will affect people not only across this country but around the world. We have to do better.
Let me just follow up and ask Delegate Foy, for you as a lawyer, why we have a question from a listener via Twitter. Why isn't the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law, not sufficient?
Oh, that's a great question. So it's not sufficient because the 14th Amendment was initially meant to address race. And over the years, the Supreme Court has extended it to sex. The issue is that gender is treated under an intermediate scrutiny standard. What that means is that it's a lower standard that has to be proven by the government when they discriminate against a woman just because she is a woman. However, there are other there's another standard called strict scrutiny. That means there has to be a compelling state interest. It is the one of the highest burdens that has to be met by a government or any person who discriminates based upon race, religion, or national origin. So whenever a person discriminates based upon those three protected classes, they fail. Discrimination fails. However, when you discriminate against a woman because we're treated at a lower standard, then it's allowed. It's usually those claims are usually successful on the part of the person who discriminated. And that is unjust and unfair. Women should be treated and in the same classification as race, gender, national origin when you are talking about the legitimacy of discriminating against us just because we are female.
My guests, listeners, if you're just joining us, are Kamala Lopez, a national leader in the national ERA movement. She's founder and executive director of the group Equal Means Equal. She's also director of the film Equal Means Equal, and a rising star in the Virginia House of Delegates, Jennifer Carroll Foy, from their second district, which is in Northern Virginia, pretty near D.C. And listeners, we could take a few phone calls on whether the Equal Rights Amendment is meaningful to you as an issue right now, or if you would support it or oppose it, or with any questions for our guests, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We'll also get into some of the Virginia news with Delegate Foy, and let's do that now a little bit, and then we'll get to the phones. Delegate Foy, the mess in Virginia. First out of Governor Northam, Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, and Attorney General Herring, who should stay and who should go, in your opinion?
So, first I would just like to say I'm, like, saddened and shocked, like a lot of people throughout Virginia and throughout the country, by the recent announcement of events. Through the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus and through the Virginia Democratic Caucus, we have all demanded the resignation of all three of our statewide electeds because we do not believe that they are in a position to be able to effectively lead here in Virginia.
So about Fairfax, some will say he has so far just been accused. There's been no public process like an FBI investigation, which he says he wants. No public airing by his accusers of evidence other than their words. Why, for you as a public defender, wouldn't you fall on the side of needing some kind of demonstration of evidence before pronouncing him guilty enough or saying you believe an accuser enough for him to lose his job?
Absolutely. Great question. So I do believe in due process, and he has not been found guilty of any crime. They are allegations. What I do believe he has asked for is an investigation, which he should be entitled to, and which he should get. The issue is that who will do it? The alleged incidents did not happen in Virginia, so Virginia do not have jurisdiction. He has also called on the FBI, but it's not a federal crime that has happened either. The legislative body, based upon the speaker's remarks and leadership remarks here in the General Assembly, is that we are not an agency or entity who can perform that type of investigative duty that's being requested, that's being asked. So that is where we are at this point. But it's a difference between being found guilty and being able to say a leader is not able to effectively lead. I think the general consensus is that there are liabilities at this point, because when we have town halls, we knock doors trying to get out the vote to make sure that we bring back not only the 48 of us, but, you know, 55, 56. That is going to be the topic of conversation, what's happened at the top level. And so we need leaders who can help fundraise and knock doors and reach out to constituents. And that's going to be troublesome. It's going to be really problematic. Now, I do agree with the general consensus that if there's any silver lining, this is an opportunity for conversation and to talk about sexual violence and rape and racism and casual racism and white privilege and all of these things, which I think is fantastic. But we also have to understand that if we're going to bring back democratic morals and values, we need Democrats in these seats and to be elected. And the issue is that can they effectively help us do that? And I think the answer has been a resounding not at this time.
Some people are calling for you to be named to replace Fairfax if he leaves as lieutenant governor. Is that something you're interested in or would accept?
I think that I am absolutely flattered that my name has been circled around as a potential person of interest to do it. I will do whatever the party needs me to do. That's why I initially ran for office. I became a delegate because I saw a void that we needed to change the conversation away from the politics and policies and the rhetoric that Trump was giving. And I wanted to talk about local kitchen table issues, Medicaid expansion, improving transportation, increasing teacher salaries, the things that affect people on a day-to-day basis. That's truly important. That's why I decided to become a delegate, and I am willing to do any and everything to push my party forward and do whatever needs to be done.
And before we take some ERA calls, some of our callers say on Governor Northam that since he has apologized for his Michael Jackson blackface and says he realizes now why that's offensive, that the important thing is his record on racial equality and racial justice as governor and in his career as a policymaker in general. How much would you agree that that should be the standard, and how would you judge his record in those regards?
So I do applaud Governor Northam for taking the charge and helping us get Medicaid expansion that gave health care to 400,000 suffering Virginians. He helped lead that charge. He did wonderful at that. I applaud him for fighting for the refundable earned income tax credit here in Virginia and beating back the failures of the failed Trump tax credit. I agree with all of those things. So on policy, I think he has done a lot. However, we cannot overlook and we must condemn the racial insensitive behaviors that were exhibited. Casual racism, structural racism is real, and people are hurt. I've heard from constituents, and they have said they have donated to our statewide. They have supported and knocked doors, and it is offensive. And I have to take that into consideration. We all have to own that because it is important and it can't be ignored. So yes, while his policies may have been great, we still have to address the issue that's before us now, and we cannot sweep that under the rug. It cannot be ignored. I understand he has said he's going to do a tour of reconciliation. He's trying to better educate himself, and that's applaudable, but you know, as far as will it be enough, that is something that the voters and constituents in Virginia has to decide.
Okay. Now, on Virginia being close to becoming the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, which would numerically put it over the top for states that have ever ratified it, for it to actually become part of the U.S. Constitution. Here's a question from Linda in Midtown Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Jennifer Carroll Foy, a Virginia state delegate, and Kamala Lopez, a leader of the national ERA movement. Linda, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question as to whether the time has passed for the ERA to actually be included as part of the Constitution. I thought that there was a time limit by which so many states had to ratify it, and if they didn't get done in that time, then it was a dead issue. I'd love to hear your guests comment on that and what the facts are. I'll take my response offline.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lopez, will you take that?
Yes, I'd love to take that. So, first of all, Equal Means Equal believes that the deadline imposed on the ERA is unconstitutional and reviewable by the courts. So the Supreme Court case that allows Congress to impose deadlines, which is called Dillon versus Gloss, is over 100 years old. And the ruling was dictum, meaning it's not binding precedent. And also, and most importantly, the reason that the Supreme Court wanted the deadline was an issue called substantial contemporaneity, which means that the amendment's passage has to be relatively close to the time in which it's being voted. Now, this provision has been completely disproven by the ratification of the 27th Amendment, the Madison Amendment, which was ratified after over 204 years. So the fact that they gave the ERA 7 and then 10, and they gave congressional pay 200 is a little bit telling. The other thing is that Congress does not have the authority to impose a deadline. Article 5 in the U.S. Constitution is crystal clear. It says that upon the ratification of 3/4 of the state, the amendment shall be included in the Constitution. And we have validation from the Archivist of the United States that this is what will occur when the 38th state is ratified.
So we should anticipate, if Virginia does ratify it as the 38th state, we're going to see a nice old court battle over this, aren't we?
Well, what we're going to do is go to court immediately to get rid of some of these sexually and gender discriminating laws. And we already have various courts, federal courts, that we're filing these cases in.
I don't mean that. I mean over whether the 38th state ratifying in this year, 2019, would count and the ERA would join the Constitution.
Right. So it's our belief, based on multiple attorneys that we've talked to, that is the law. We've spoken to the archivists. We've spoken to various top constitutional attorneys. When the 38th state is ratified, the ERA is ratified. If people disagree with that, we'll meet them in court.
Okay.
But that is what the Constitution says.
You ready for some deep history? I think we're going to get some from Jan in Manhattan. Jan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, Brian. I was an intern in the Nebraska unicameral during the 1973 ERA rescission hearings. It was probably one of the most disturbing experiences of my life.
Does that mean, just for listeners' background, that the Nebraska legislature had passed the ERA to join the Constitution, but then rescission, they were looking to reverse themselves on that?
Exactly. And Phyllis Schlafly herself was there to testify, and all of the people testifying, they managed to get all women who came to testify to say how horrible it would be for women if the ERA was passed. But my question is, the rescission happened, and now your guest is saying that if Virginia passes the ERA, it will become law. We will have 3/4 of the states.
Well, and let me jump in there just because we're running out of time in the segment. And I think your question is clear. Jan, we really appreciate that story. Ms. Lopez, is Nebraska on the list of the 38 as a yes?
Yes. So the archivist has also stated, as have multiple scholars, that rescission is not an option. A later rescission of a state's ratification is not valid. So once you have ratified the amendment, that amendment is ratified. If we allowed rescissions, God knows how many states would try and back out of giving black people the right to be citizens.
So that's
it's not an option.
That's another way. That's another way, I guess, you would meet opponents in court. We're almost out of time. I want to ask you, Delegate Foy, one other thing. You are the only public defender I see in the Virginia legislature. We know prosecutors often then go into elected politics. I couldn't find figures for the Virginia legislature, but listen to this. Maybe you know. Listeners, listen to this. The current Congress has 47 former prosecutors, including 12 out of the 100 U.S. senators. So I wonder if you think being a public defender gives you a certain knowledge base and perspective about criminal justice reforms. And I also wonder if you're taking a position on the presidential race that some progressives have taken, that Kamala Harris should be disqualified from consideration politically just based on her record as a prosecutor.
Yes. So as far as being a public, my experience as a public defender, I think it fully informs the legislation that I put forth, and I have an intimate knowledge of the failures of the criminal justice system and the ways that the tough-on-crime narrative has failed society, that I have an understanding that we cannot incarcerate ourselves out of addiction. All of those things and experiences I try to bring here, and you can see it in the legislation that I've proposed, such as reforming the cash bail system, because we have a two-tiered system here where you can actually purchase your freedom. It does not necessarily mean that you're not a danger to yourself, the community, or you're guaranteed to come to court. It's just about how much money you have in your wallet or in your bank account or your zip code. And that's not the way that our criminal justice system should work. The bill I brought forth for automatic expungements. If you are found not guilty of a crime, in Virginia, you still have to pay in order to get that charge removed off your criminal history. That can keep you from getting jobs, even housing, and that's not just. So automatic expungements for people who are found to be not guilty of crimes. Driver license suspensions, which is now currently being litigated in court in Virginia. If you don't pay your court fines and fees, we suspend your license, preventing you from being able to go to work, to earn a living, to pay your rent, to pay for food. And so my bill was to eliminate driver license suspensions for failure to pay court fines and fees. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I advocate for the poor, and I advocate for unjust legislation that disparately impacts minorities, because that is what I've seen, that's what I know, and that is why you need people from different experiences and race and religion to all come to the table, because that is when you diversify the conversation and you can have a global response to a lot of our everyday problems. As far as the presidential race, so I reserve any decision until I see all the candidates that's coming out, because almost every day we have a new person who is announcing, and I want to hear all of their policies and philosophies and things that they want to fight for, because I want to make sure that the person that I get behind, I am behind 100%. But we have some amazing Democratic candidates that's coming out in this announced so far, so I'm really excited.
And some time to decide. Virginia House of Delegates member Jennifer Carroll Foy, literally a rising star in that she was just nominated for the Emily's List, Gabrielle Giffords Rising Star Award a few days ago, and is sponsor of an Equal Rights Amendment resolution in the Virginia legislature and the Virginia House of Delegates that could put the ERA over the top in terms of states needed to ratify, and a leader of the national ERA movement, Kamala Lopez, founder of the group and director of the film Equal Means Equal. Thank you both so much for joining us. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.